MacCast, Sunday, November 17th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, another week has gone by, another week of Mac news and information and what have you. Also, some great emails and comments from you. Got a great show for you this week, although it's going to be a little bit shorter on the news. Not a lot happening, really. You know, Apple builds up and builds up to these giant events now. Looks like they're happening about once a year. Come out with all these great products, and then we sit around and wait for the next thing to come. When that is going to happen, I don't know, but it looks like they're set with their lineup through the end of the year, at least as far as most of the things I'm reading. Of course, they released the new iPad mini with Retina display this past week, so we'll talk about that a little bit, and a couple of other things. We've got some news for you there, and then I have some feedback from you, but then the big news is that our friend David Sparks has been up to something, and I was able to snag an interview with him about his new project and what's going on there. So we're going to learn a little bit and then dive into how to better manage our email here in the back half of the show. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. Actually, a new sponsor here on the MacCast, and it's Lynda.com. I am so happy to have Lynda.com on board as a new sponsor of the MacCast because I love Lynda.com. It is awesome. I've used it many times over the years. For those of you who don't know, Lynda.com is a site. They offer high-quality video courses to help you learn just about anything, whether you're a creative, a business type, someone who does software or programming. They have a ton of courses. I've used Lynda.com to brush up on my skills, not only as a developer, but also as a designer. I think one of the greatest things about the site actually is the fact that you have access to an incredible depth of training in all kinds of different categories. They pretty much cover everything. I think there's over 2,000 different courses, and they're adding new courses daily. I've used it to brush up on my Photoshop skills, learn new tricks in Mac OS X, also to learn new programming skills, be it JavaScript or CSS or HTML or even advanced stuff like PHP and MySQL. It's really, really good stuff. They offer courses in business software, 3D, video, audio, literally you name it, you're probably going to find it on there. And all for one low monthly price of just $25. It gives you access to everything in their entire catalog. And the courses that they have, something I like also is they're broken up into smaller chunks, so you can kind of learn at your own pace. You can do it on your own time. It'll even keep track of what you've watched and where you're at. So you really have the option. You can do a whole course all at once, just blast through the whole thing, or grab it in bits and pieces when you don't have a lot of time. So that's a really nice feature. And I also appreciate the quality of their instructors. These are some of the best people in their respective fields teaching you stuff. What could be better? And all the courses are organized by subject, by software, by author. They make it really easy to find what you're looking for. I noticed recently they added a bunch of new courses in Mac OS X Maverick, so you might want to check those out. And one of them's even taught by Macworld's Chris Breen. So that just gives you a sense of the kinds of people they have giving training over on Lynda.com. I really want you to check it out, and we have a deal for you. You can get free trial access to the entire library, the whole collection, just by going to lynda.com/MacCast. There you'll find out all the details about the service, see the various kinds of plans they have to offer, and I even had them throw in some links to some courses I think might be of particular interest to you as a MacCast listener. So check all that stuff out. You can get started with your free trial at lynda.com. That's lynda.com/MacCast. Do it today. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. As I mentioned in the intro, the Retina Mac Mini or iPad Mini. I said Mac Mini. I meant iPad Mini. The Retina iPad Mini is out and available, although you may not have known it. At least if Apple had their way. They actually did a very odd move on Tuesday morning in the wee hours at midnight. That was right after I recorded the last MacCast. They soft launched the iPad mini with a Retina display. We knew it was coming out sometime later in November, sometime after the iPad Air, and it turned out to be Tuesday the 12th. Since then, availability has been seriously constrained. They're kind of hard to get a hold of, although it does seem if you do want one, you can get it in a few different places. You just have to kind of be on the ball and be paying attention, kind of waiting and checking and stuff like that. So they're out there, but they're kind of slowly trickling out, at least as near as I can tell. You'll have to do a little bit of digging, but Apple does try to help you out a little bit. If you go on their website, you can check availability of inventory in store, at least in the US and the UK. I'm not sure about other countries, but I know those two countries. You can go in, you can find the iPad mini with a Retina display model you'd like, and then you can see if it's available in your local retail store. I found that by checking after closing time in your region, that's about the best time to see if you can reserve one for maybe in-store pickup on the next day. I think they sort of refresh their inventory at the end of the day, so if they get some shipments in during the day, anything that isn't sold out, right in store that afternoon shows up in the inventory list that night. So that seems to be the best time to do it if you're trying to get your hands on one. I know several of you have them already, as I've gotten some feedback and some early impressions. So we'll try and get those shared out on an upcoming episode of the MacCast. I think, you know, for those of you who are wondering, I have sort of decided that my iPad Air is actually going to be just fine. I wasn't sure because my iPad mini, my non-Retina mini right now is probably my favorite iPad, but slowly that's transitioning to my new iPad Air. I think that's kind of, for me, the best combination between size and weight and still having a full-size screen to work on. I like to take notes and things like that on the larger iPad, and I think the iPad Air is going to be the best iPad for me. But I don't think that necessarily means it's the best iPad for everyone. I know people who really, size is the main thing, and they really want that Retina quality display. So the mini is the best iPad for them. And what's really cool, I think, now is we sort of have the best iPad mini with no compromises in each size. So you really can pick which size form factor works best for you, and then you don't have to worry about all those other specifications. So I think Apple did something really smart. But sort of getting back to the mini, the reason why Apple rolled out in such an odd manner, did this secret midnight rollout, seems to be, at least a consensus is among most people, to better manage the sort of constrained inventory that they have. They basically haven't been able to produce nearly enough units to meet, I think, what the estimated demand is. So by sort of quietly rolling it out, what they ensured was that mostly just the Apple Watchers, sort of the diehards, really knew about the release on at least launch day. And that way they could sort of manage the number of people coming in store, going online and trying to order and stuff like that. Obviously, since then, the word has spread and more people are aware the iPad mini with the Retina display is out and available. So it's getting harder and harder to get hold of. And it sounds like it's going to be that way through the end of the year. There have been rumors that Apple's going to try and bring on some more suppliers early in 2014. The main theory actually behind the whole inventory constraint is that Apple suppliers are having a hard time with production yields on that Retina display for the iPad mini. It has the same resolution as the full-size iPad, so, and also as the iPhone 5S, so it's got a much higher pixel density, 326 pixels per inch, and that seems to be the source of the trouble. Now, typically the way they handle that in the supply chain, and it sounds like what they're doing in this case, is they have multiple display suppliers, but all of them are supposedly having a little bit of trouble. Specifically, though, we're hearing that Sharp, with their IGZO panels, is that one is being particularly troublesome. And I had read a report that Apple supposedly has been rejecting a large number of the Sharp panels because they had a burn-in issue. I think we talked about that on the last episode. The reports were that the burn-in was there, but it wasn't anything that was perceptible to the human eye. But the panels still weren't meeting Apple's quality standards, so they were getting very low yields out of the sharp shipments. And this week, Instapaper developer Marco Arment reported that his Retina iPad Mini was actually showing signs of burn-in in some of the testing he was doing. So he had developed a web page that would display a black and white checkerboard pattern on the screen. You'd leave that up for several minutes and then switch over to a gray screen. And what you could see was a soft residual image that would then sort of fade away. But that is what the burn-in is. And since then, we've seen some other posts of other people reporting the issue after running that test, although it does seem to be pretty isolated. So I don't think it's a widespread issue, but it is out there. If you do have one of the affected displays, if you try this out on your new Retina iPad Mini, your best bet is to probably take it back to Apple, see if they'll get you a replacement. And if you can, you'll probably want to test your replacement unit in store before you take it out, just in case, because you're not going to know until you actually open the box whether you have an affected display or not. But I really think it's an isolated issue. Most of the reports I'm seeing of people testing this, they're saying theirs are just fine. So I don't think it's a widespread epidemic, but certainly something to be aware of. Now that the iPad Mini with Retina display is out there in the wild, of course, iFixit grabbed one and tore it apart. They did their typical teardown. And while there were few surprises, there were actually, well, at least one big surprise and one minor one. Inside, as expected, it's basically an iPad Air, but scaled down, the same A7 processor, M7 coprocessor, same cameras, all that sort of stuff. We kind of knew that going into it, but the A7 processor does run slightly slower at a slightly lower clock speed than the one in the iPad Air. The iPad Mini's processor is clocked at 1.3 gigahertz, whereas the iPad Air's is 1.4 gigahertz. No knowing why Apple slightly clocked it differently, and probably most users aren't going to tell any difference in terms of performance, so not a big issue there. But the one big surprise was that the battery in the new Retina iPad Mini is actually much larger than the previous generation, 24.3 watt hours versus 16.3 watt hours in the prior generation. The runtime remains pretty much exactly the same, I think 10 hours in most use cases, according to Apple specifications. So I assume that all that extra battery power, all that extra juice is being mostly used to drive that gorgeous new Retina display. And the display, from all accounts, is awesome. A lot of people are very, very happy with the new Retina iPad Mini. So if you picked yours up and you have some initial thoughts and impressions, please share those with us. Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. There's a new update for OS X Mavericks, at least available to developers. Apple has seeded the first OS X Mavericks update, 10.9.1, to developers. It's identified as build 13B27, and it is pre-release software meant just for developer testing at this point. Because of Apple's developers' NDAs, there's not a lot of details, so we don't know a lot about what's in there, but we do know that Apple wants testers to focus mainly on checking out the mail, graphics, and voiceover features, so we can expect that there'll be updates included for those components. No word on when we might see the update released, but when it does come out, it will be the first point release of Mac OS X Mavericks. Last week, we did see Apple push out a minor patch to address some of the issues with mail in Mavericks, but that release only changed the build number. It wasn't a full point release. So we do expect 10.9.1 to come out probably in the next few weeks, since it has been released to developers for at least some initial testing. Apple also issued an update to iOS 7, the fourth update. iOS 7 7.0.4 was released and specifically mentions fixing an issue that caused FaceTime calls to fail for some users. So if you were experiencing that problem, you're going to want to make sure you grab this one. In addition, the update also is said to contain additional bug fixes and improvements, something Apple typically posts when they are doing an iOS update. Doesn't give us a lot of details as to exactly what's fixed, but that seems to be their standard boilerplate. Also, along with 7.0.4, they also released an update to the Apple TV. It's now updated to version 6.0.2. There were no obvious new features in that update, and the release notes simply stated that it includes general performance and stability improvements. So If you haven't received those updates yet and you'd like them, just simply go into Software Update on your respective devices, run that, and that should get you up to date. And then finally in the news for this week, it looks like Apple's getting close to acquiring another company. iMore is reporting that it looks like Apple might be just a few days away from finalizing a deal to buy the company PrimeSense. PrimeSense is an Israeli sensor company, and they actually developed the 3D visual sensor system that was used originally in the Microsoft Xbox Kinect product. If you're not familiar with that product, that's actually a little bar that went and connected to your Xbox that would allow you to do motion control. So you could use your body and gestures to actually control things on the screen or within the Xbox. The company's technology can actually be used to map out 3D environments and track movements of bodies, faces, and even facial expressions. And then that data could be used to do all sorts of things from facial recognition to actual gesture control. I think in the case of Microsoft, they have moved on and started to develop their own technology, so they no longer use PrimeSense. But obviously, they have Apple's interest. Rumors of the acquisition actually started floating around back in July, and now they seem to be heating up again, at least according to some more recent reports. Back then, the rumors were saying Apple was set to acquire the company for about $280 million. It looks like now the deal could be worth as much as $345 million. I guess we'll find out in a few days if this does come to fruition. As for what Apple would want to do with the company and the technology, you know, your imagination is probably as good as mine, but we did get some rumors back when we were hearing about a possible development of an Apple television or maybe updates to the current Apple TV set-top box that Apple would like to bake in gesture controls so you could control on-screen menus and stuff like that through body movements. That always seemed a little bit odd to me, but I guess they could use the technology for that. But if you look at iOS and Macs, there's also some interesting applications for things, especially like gaming, using maybe the FaceTime camera that's in those devices. But we've got EyeSight cameras and all kinds of interesting sensor technology going into Apple products. So they really could be used for almost anything. I would also imagine that Apple has some ideas that they could use the technology for things that we haven't even fathomed yet, stuff we haven't even thought of. They seem to be pretty good at that, in my opinion. And as a matter of fact, if you remember, Tim Cook said back at the D11 conference that, quote, the whole sensor field is going to explode. It's all over the place right now. And with the arc of time, it will become clearer. So I think Apple's going to try and clear some things up for us, and maybe they will use the acquisition of PrimeSense to be another nice stick of dynamite in their sensor technology portfolio to kind of create that explosion in the sensor field, specifically with as it relates to Apple's products. So that's a cool thing, but that is about it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, I am a huge fan of Smile. They make a bunch of great products, but most recently, they came out with a new iOS app, PDF Scan Plus. And if you'd like to have a document scanner always on hand in your pocket and you have an iOS device, PDF Scan Plus makes that possible. It is super easy to scan documents in high quality right on your iOS device using the app. It's quick and easy. It has all of the tools you need to get your images in fast and looking really good. The way it works is simple. You just take out your camera, you snap a picture, or you could even import one from your camera roll, and then it automatically will crop and size to a standard paper size. You can visually enhance the image to get better readability. You can manually adjust the quality. It'll try and do it automatically for you, but you can also adjust it manually, and then you can save that image out in color, grayscale, or text. So now you have a high quality scan in PDF format, and you can do anything with it that you would normally do with a PDF. You can even send it to PDF Pen right on your iOS device, and you can add annotations and do all that cool stuff that PDF Pen lets you do with your PDFs. And then if you want to share it, if you need to get it off somewhere, you could put it into iCloud, you can send it to another app. They also have integrated support for Dropbox, Evernote, Box, Alfresco, Google Drive, all your favorite cloud-based services, and you can export to iTunes, send via FTP or WebDAV. So you get a lot of options, and all that alone would be awesome enough, but I haven't even told you the best part, because PDF Pen Scan Plus will also OCR your document right there on your iOS device. It even highlights as it scans through your document and then embeds the OCR data right inside your PDF, making it completely searchable. And you can even copy out the OCR text and paste it into another app. So if you want to send it via email. So this is a great way to take a physical document, get the text out, and be able to use it and send it off somewhere. And all for a price that's amazing. Just $4.99 in the App Store. It is a great deal. So go grab it now. PDF Scan Plus, available on the App Store. And also be sure to head over to smilesoftware.com and check out all their other great products: Text Expander, PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. The list goes on and on. Great stuff. Love Smile, smilesoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I have a little bit of follow-up for you from the last episode of the MacCast. On the last show, we brought up an issue in iOS 7's music app. A listener discovered it was particularly tricky to get the player to shuffle music by genre. And in that episode, he had discovered a sort of workaround that involved using the search feature within the music app to actually get the results he wanted. So you could use search and then shuffle from there, but actually just kind of drilling down through the genre category, it was really hard to get it to shuffle the songs. And then after that episode aired, a lot of you wrote in to tell me that there actually is an easier way in iOS 7 to get the music app to shuffle by genre. And here's what several of you had to tell me.
Hi, Adam. This is John from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I just finished listening to the most recent podcast, in particular with regards to the apparent lack of iOS 7's ability to shuffle music by genre within the music app. I found an easy way that doesn't require any of the workarounds you described. The answer is simply ask Siri to do it for you. When I ask Siri to play some classical music or play me some reggae, she just goes ahead and randomly plays all of my music that matches the requested genre. It's that simple. Hopefully, this solves most people's problems. I've been listening to your podcast for about a year or so now and really enjoy it every week. Keep up the good work, and thanks again for all you do for all of us out here.
Hi, Adam. My name is Walt from Toronto, Canada. In episode 467, you were discussing how to shuffle songs within a particular genre. I've discovered a much easier way to do so. Just ask Siri to play, for instance, classical music, and he or she will do so and automatically shuffle the genre for you. Hope this helps. Love your show. Keep up the great work. Take care. Bye.
Okay, so now I have to admit, as one of Siri's biggest fans, I am a bit embarrassed. You know I like Siri. I can't believe I didn't think of this one. It's a great tip. Thank you to Walt and to John and to everybody else who wrote in to remind me that, hey, Siri can do this sort of thing. That's great. The one caveat, obviously, here is that you do need to have a device that supports Siri, but still a great tip, and I wanted to share that with everyone. Now I want to talk about a couple of little Mavericks bugs. I know Mavericks is out there. Many of you are using it. I still haven't upgraded my main system. I'm waiting for maybe a couple patches to come out, but I've been playing around with it on my iPad Air, and I've discovered one thing, and I also got an email from Michael, who received a very odd error that we were able to work through, and I wanted to point out to you because there was a discussion thread, and I think some other people are running into this issue. Basically, Michael was getting this error message at startup every time he booted up his Mac running Mavericks about his keychain. It would say com.apple.internetaccounts.xpc wants to use the mic, in his case, keychain. I would assume it'd be whatever username you're using if you saw the error message. Please enter the keychain password. And he was able to enter the password, and that would get past it until the next reboot. And then that message would show up again and again and again. Got really annoying, and he was wondering, you know, what's going on and how do I get past this? Well, I found a solution over on Apple's discussion boards. I'll have a link to the full thread in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. But basically, the fix is to go in and reset the keychain. So what you do is you go into Keychain Access, so Application Utilities, Keychain Access, and then from the menu, you're going to want to select Keychain Access and then Preferences, or so from the Keychain Access menu, select Preferences, and then under General, click the Reset My Default Keychain option. It's going to ask you to enter your username and password, I'm assuming the admin one, and then it will remove your user keychain and rebuild it. Now, that's important there. It's going to actually delete your user keychain, so just be aware of that because you're probably going to have to go back through and re-enter all of your saved passwords after you perform this procedure. But the good news is if you are running into that error message at boot up, that should go away. So you have a little bit of rebuilding to do. Obviously, the caveat always applies. Make a full backup before you do anything like this major on your system, just in case things go south. But I think that fix worked for Michael and will likely work for you if you run into this issue. The other little issue that I discovered has not so much to do with Mavericks, but with the new version of Pages. I was playing around with the new version of Pages, trying some things out, and I created some new documents in iCloud, so documents in the cloud, and I found that the next time I went back to try and open those documents, I kept getting this error message saying that Pages couldn't open the file, and it was baffling to me because I had just created these files, closed out of the application, and now when I came back, I could not open them up, and it was just this cryptic error message, cannot open the file, and I could go into iCloud.com and open the files there, no problem, and I did a little digging around, and it turned out that the answer was I had to completely log out of the iCloud account on my Mac and then log back in to fix the issue. So I had to go into System Preferences, into iCloud, log out of my account, which was a little bit scary because it'll start to pop up several warning messages about removing stuff from iCloud.com or asking you if you want to remove stuff from your Mac, rather, in most cases, or mentioning that, hey, this is going to disconnect things from iCloud.com. What I did when I saw those messages was basically tell it to leave any local copies of things like my contacts, etc., on my Mac, and then blew through those, and when I logged back in, everything seemed to be fine, because what should happen is it should start to resync things back up and pull everything back down from iCloud. So I think it warns you that it's going to delete the local copies of your iCloud documents. So it'll leave the ones in iCloud and delete the local ones. And then also for stuff on your Mac, like I said, like your contacts, you're going to want to leave that stuff in there, tell it to keep those sorts of things. And then it'll sync everything back up and you should be okay. Again, make sure you have a backup before you actually try this if you've run into this issue. But logging back in should bring everything back to normal. And once I did that, Pages with the iCloud documents that I had saved there, they all opened up just fine. So I don't know what got out of sync. Maybe it's just because I did an over-the-top upgrade and I already had my iCloud accounts set up, but it kind of needed a little reboot, and that's what I had to do there. So if you've run into either of those bugs, there's a couple fixes for you. And if you've discovered any bugs in Mavericks and would like some help sort of troubleshooting them, or better yet, if you found a bug and have a solution for it, if you want to share those with us, I would be very happy to try and get the word out, because I know that we're all, you know, sort of in this upgrade together. We're going through the new update to Mavericks. It's a pretty significant one, and we're going to run into little bumps and hiccups like this. So the more information we can share with each other, the better. Just shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. A feature of Apple's operating system that they've been building on and expanding in the last few iterations is the share button and the share features, particularly share features and options that are integrated with a lot of our favorite web services, things like LinkedIn and Twitter and what have you. And the idea behind that integration is sort of to make it easier for us to share stuff through those services. And while Apple does a pretty good job most of the time, it's not all the time that those things work, I think, the way that we expect them to, or maybe in some cases they aren't quite as convenient as they should be. And that was something that Todd ran into this week, and he sent me this audio comment about it.
Hey, Adam, Todd McCann from the Trucker Dump Podcast here again. I recently heard you talking on one of the 37 million podcasts that you do about the horrible search in the App Store, and how you were talking about how, you know, it sucks because people are gaming the system. Well, at least there's an excuse for that bad search. I'm having bad search on my Mac, specifically in the share button area. So say like you go to Safari and you pull up a web page and you want to share it with a friend. You click the share button and then you click Twitter and then you start typing someone's name, like their username. And say that name starts with a D. Well, it pulls up five or six different people who I am actually following, but it's never, I can't recall it ever happening that it's actually the person that I'm looking for. And as a matter of fact, if you keep typing the name and you finish the name and you spell it exactly the way it is, you know, it's supposed to be with capitalization and everything, it still doesn't bring up that name. And I don't understand it. So what's the point of having the search if it's not even going to bring up the right name for you? I just wondered if you had experienced this or if it was just me. I was hoping the problem would go away when I upgraded to Mavericks, but it's still here. And I've had this problem ever since that little share button has been there. So if you've got any clue what's going on, I would certainly appreciate it because it makes that share button virtually worthless. Kind of like the search in the App Store. Okay, take it easy, Adam. And thanks for all you do. Love the show. And I voted for you.
So did you vote for all 37 million podcasts that I'm on? No, actually, I really appreciate the vote. For those of you who don't know, I was up for a podcast award this year. I have never won that podcast award thing, and I kind of made a play this time around on Twitter for votes. So I was pleading for votes, and Todd, I appreciate you taking the time to go and do that. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll actually win an award, bring it home this year. But getting to your issue, I think actually, and I haven't confirmed this, I think the issue actually is that those search results, those sort of autocomplete that happens in that tweet sheet, that information comes from your contacts. And so if you haven't added a person's Twitter handle to their contact record, then it's not going to show up. It doesn't actually go out and access the user accounts in Twitter's database. It uses that local copy that you have. So it's somewhat limited. You know, on the Mac, you can go into your internet accounts if you're running Mavericks. If you're running pre-Mavericks, it's going to be in Mail, Contacts, and Calendars. And when you go to the Twitter account settings in there, there's a little Update Contacts button. When you click that, I think it'll ask you if it's okay for it to go through your contacts list and actually use the email to try and match up and pull down matching Twitter usernames. So you can actually have it auto-populate and update your contact, your address book. But when you're using the share feature in Mac OS X, it's going to be limited to just those names that are in there. So when you're typing that at name, that's all you're going to get. So I think that's why it's not showing up for you. Apple, you know, obviously could do a better job. And it's honestly why I avoid mostly using Apple's share options, specifically for Twitter, for sending tweets. For that, I just end up using a dedicated client, something like Tweetbot, which is my favorite on the Mac. And even there, I sometimes struggle with that issue. So I don't think this is an Apple exclusive problem, but I think they could do a better job at it. And so I would agree with you there. I think they need to do an even better job with search for apps in the iTunes store. That's why I use Appler. And I think that's what I mentioned on that other show, getappler.com, which is Michael Johnston's social app discovery service. So you can go follow me there. I'm the MacCast on there, and you can see all the apps that I'm buying and recommend. And then I can see yours. It's actually really, really cool. So check that out. But thanks for your email, and hopefully that helps shed some light on why you can't find your tweet peeps when using the share sheet. And now the last thing, but certainly not the least thing that I have for you in this episode, our friend David Sparks, Mac Sparky from Mac Power Users, he's actually just come out with the fourth book in his Mac Sparky Field Guide series, which is this awesome series of iBooks, all created an iBooks author. These great interactive, they've got, you know, full screencasts and audio interviews and great screenshots and all that stuff. Books that just get into all of the nitty-gritty about a specific topic. And the first one he did was on going paperless. It's like the Bible for that sort of thing. I learned so much from that book, and I actually have a whole new workflow because of it. Then he did, I think, Mountain Lion Tips was the second one. Hopefully I'm not getting that wrong. David will correct me if I did. But the Mountain Lion Tips, and then he did Markdown. And now his newest one is all about email, something that all of us have to deal with on a daily basis. And a lot of us, I think, struggle with, myself included. So you can now get a copy of this book on the iBookstore. Go grab it. You will not be sorry. But I figured we could get David on the show because he's a good friend. He could come in, he could talk to us about the new book, about the process of creating these things, but also give us a sneak peek of what's in it. We can talk about email a little bit here, and I even get him to give us some tips, so you get some stuff out of the book without even having to get it. But please just go grab the book, because there's tons of more stuff in there. I mean, he goes, and I think he's the first to admit that this is what he tries to do. He goes into, I think he calls it excruciating detail on all of these topics, and he is not kidding, but it's of great benefit to all of us. So here's my conversation with Mac Sparky, Dave Sparks, about email. Hey, David, how you doing?
Outstanding. How are you, Adam?
Yeah, I bet you now you've got a new book off your plate.
Yeah, it's time for a cold one, as they say.
I can only imagine how much work goes into one of these things, but we don't want to talk about that. I want to talk to you about just the topic in general, because I was actually very excited about this one. We've already kind of mentioned you have a new field guide out, email, and I have to tell you, I probably need this book more than any of the others you've written so far, because I'm okay with my email, but I really don't have a system. You know, it's just sort of, I just deal with it, which is probably not the best way. Right.
Well, that's one of the things about email is there isn't one system. I mean, everybody has a lot of different demands on their time and different levels of priority for email. So that was one of the reasons why this book was such a challenge, is I wanted to give readers a chance to kind of educate themselves and see a variety of systems so they could pick what works for them best. And it was quite a challenge, but I think it came out good.
Yeah. And again, this is you do these things in iBooks Author, so I want to talk to you a little bit about that maybe toward the end of this thing. But let's talk a little bit about, I mean, I guess my main curiosity, and you alluded to it a little bit there, but a little more in depth. I mean, you've gone through paperless, which made sense. You know, me knowing you, I know you're big on that, and then Markdown. I mean, like you said, email is such a tricky thing to tackle. How come you picked that for this one?
Yeah. Well, in addition to the fact that I'm a masochist, I mean, this book really was hard, much harder than the prior ones. But I needed this book. You know, I had kind of, I even wrote about it in the email book, kind of my epiphany at one point when I realized that email was controlling me instead of me controlling email. And I needed to stop and figure out why. And so there's kind of a psychological component to it, but I also needed to figure out how I could change that. And of course, because I can't help myself, I didn't just figure it out for myself. I wrote a book about it.
Right. To help everybody else. And I won't give it away, but one of my favorite parts of the book actually so far, and I've only had it for a little while, so I haven't gotten all the way through it. But in the foreword, in the front part of it, you have this great story about E.B. White. People should, just that part to me was worth the whole the whole book in and of itself. But we won't give it away. That. But there's a great story.
When I read that, I said, you know, it's just like, this is not a new problem.
Yeah, you know? Don't you love that? Yeah, it's like, this is not something that's brought on by technology. This is just, like, brought on by, you know, our lives, right? And it's more about this management of information. And I think more and more of us, especially with computers and technology and now devices like iPads and things like that, we have access and we are bombarded by this communication all the time, right?
Yeah, it's just so much easier for people to get your time now. I mean, it used to be that if you wanted me to read a letter, you had to get a piece of paper and a pencil, and you had to get an envelope, and you had to lick a stamp, and you had to pay money for the stamp. And so there was all these pieces involved before you could get my time and attention. And now it's really easy with emails. And as a result, it's increased exponentially. And so now we need more than ever ways to deal with this problem.
Right, right. And so, like a lot of your books, this is, you know, still got a lot of stuff about workflows, but, you know, you also get into just the technology of email itself. And then, like you said, this sort of this philosophical level that I think really helps people. I know almost immediately a couple things helped me just sort of wrap my head around, you know, understanding my own personal workflows and sort of ways of dealing with email, right? Or communications in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. And there's part of us that wants to be the guy or lady that always answers all the email within a day of receiving it. You know, it's like you build this expectation of yourself that that's who you are.
Right.
But you also have to go to work and brush your teeth and feed your kids and do all these other things. And what happens when you have more email than you have time to deal with in that perception of yourself that you have? And I get kind of hippie about that stuff too. But it's, you know, it really is a difficult issue. But at the, you know, to be honest, getting through this book was really good for me because I did find a bunch of automation tools and a bunch of ways to kind of get better at it and also just think better about email. So I'm not, you know, putting all these burdens on myself all the time.
Right. Right. As you were, I'm curious, as you were doing research for the book and stuff like that. So, like, you and I, you know, being podcasters and having this sort of thing, and I know you're in an office environment where I'm sure you deal with a lot of email. You know, we kind of have these special needs when it comes to email. I initially sort of felt, I guess, sort of before reading your book, that I was in this special scenario, you know, that like I'm the type of person who gets more email than the average Joe. But did you find as you were kind of doing it that really this isn't just limited to certain, you know, types of people or, you know, I know you did some interviews with some pretty well-known Hollywood folks and stuff like that that are in there as well. You know, obviously they're going to be dealing with and getting a lot of email, but it seems like it's becoming a wider spread problem. And
that's when I did those workflow interviews. I tried to I include Jeff, who's a doctor, and I included an IT guy. And I wanted people from all walks of life to be represented because I do think you're right. I think everybody has this problem and everybody's got these bosses who email them and then are angry if they don't get a reply in 5 minutes. But meanwhile, they want you sitting at your desk working on other stuff all the time and not taking your time reading email.
Right.
It's irreconcilable. And, you know, it's just not fair. And so all of us, we need some tools to kind of help fight this monster.
Right. There's this sense of immediacy and urgency and those sorts of things. Another particular element that I respond to very well and like, and I don't know where this came from. So I, in my life, have always railed against the notification.
Yeah.
Just as a concept in general, you know, and Apple rolling this into my iOS devices and into my Mac and every application I seem to install now says, we would like to send you notifications. And my default answer has been no. And it rolls all the way back to Growl. I think most people know Growl, but before Apple had notifications built in, which work actually a lot like Growl, there was this third party tool called Growl, which I think still exists and is integrated in a lot of applications. And it basically allowed developers to have an API where they could, you know, push up notifications. I have always said that those things were just something I don't generally want on my system. And I find myself caving. You know, I'm allowing more notifications than I ever have before.
It's because it takes effort to turn them off. You know, when I do these screencasts and stuff, a lot of times I take my iPad and I kind of rebuild it clean because I don't want all my personal stuff in, you know, these books. And so I was looking at some of the screenshots from the book, and I've got all these notifications on for all these apps just because I wasn't using them, and they just natively put notifications on. And I feel like I almost went too hard at notifications in the book. I don't know if you've got to that section yet, but I'm really, you know, anal about saying don't use them.
Right.
And in the end of the day, I actually turn them on, but I only turn them on for VIPs, and I'm very careful about who gets on the VIP list. Like, for instance, you know, I don't know if you're using Apple Mail or not. You're a Gmail guy, aren't you?
Yeah, but I have Gmail integrated with Apple Mail, and I have for a while. Although we should talk about that in a second.
Yeah, that should be another topic. But for instance, you know, I generally use, like, for Mac Sparky account, I use an IMAP account, and I aggressively use those VIPs. I knew that I was going to be doing this interview with you, so. Mm-hmm. A couple days ago, I put you as a VIP. And so if you had emailed me this morning saying, you know, you had to go, you know, take your kid to the doctor or whatever, I would have found out right away. And that's kind of nice. And then after the interview's over, I'll just flip you off as, well, that didn't sound right, did it? I'll turn you off as a VIP until the next time you and I are going to get together for a sandwich or something. And so I'm very fluid with those because the Apple Mail makes it really easy on the iPad or the Mac to turn those off and on. So when I'm active with somebody, I'll turn them on with VIPs. And that way I do get notifications, but they're very rare and they're from people that I really want to be notified from.
Right. Right. Yeah. So the whole notifications thing is just, I share a philosophy with you on that. Although, like I said, it's really hard to almost avoid, but our lives become, I find notifications make our lives sort of become interrupt driven, right? There's that immediate, oh, it's there. I gotta click on that thing.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And it's I was just going to say, it's getting even worse with the replies, right? I haven't moved to Mavericks on my main system yet, but I know that, you know, having that ability to reply right from the notification is going to make me want to pay more attention to it. Cause it's like, oh, I can just, you know, I don't know if that makes it, what I haven't decided is that going to make it better for me or is it going to make it worse?
Well, see, I think if once again, everybody has to make their own decisions. If you've got a extremely low volume of email, leaving it on, I guess makes sense, but I don't. So I have VIPs turned on for those notifications.
Sure.
So like if you had said, hey, Dave, I need to move our interview back an hour, I'm going to go to the store, I could have replied right there and say, that's fine. And that would have worked because you showed up as a VIP. So it you know, everybody picks their own level of insanity with this stuff. What, you know, on the notifications, one of the points I made in the book is if you took a notification setting, which the default in Apple Mail is 5 minutes, but even with push email now, it's even more than that, really.
Right.
But let's just assume you get an interruption every 5 minutes. To me, I find that really hard to resist. When I, you know, the reason why I'm so against notifications is I'm powerless to resist them because I assume that it's going to be an email from somebody that's going to be really important, and it's usually someone trying to sell me Viagra. And so I turn that off. But if I allowed myself to be interrupted every 5 minutes, that's 12 times an hour. And if you work a 12-hour day, you know, assuming all the things you carry in your pocket and all that, right?
Right.
It adds up to 52,000 interruptions a year. I mean, could you imagine letting someone interrupt you 52,000 times a year? And how would you get any work done? You know, so there definitely wouldn't be any more Mac Sparky field guides if I had those notifications on.
Well, there wouldn't be anything. There wouldn't be anything else. And I think that's, I mean, that's a really big deal. Not just, I mean, I know your book's about email, but just about workflows and our lives and computers in general is we really have to sort of be on top of not allowing our technology to control us. And I think more and more everybody's wrestling with this, you know, between, you know, text messages and all the social ramifications and things like that. So it really does kind of spread out further than just one technology or one thing.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree.
And so it was great to see you kind of tackling some of those things and, you know, giving that reminder to folks like me, like, hey, you know, you gotta sort of watch out for these things. And you can flip it around, right? That's another big part of this, is you can flip it around and you can take some of the technology and the tools that you have to combat that.
Yeah. And there's some really great stuff showing up in the email right now. I mean, this problem isn't a mystery. A lot of people are struggling with email, and there are some really great third-party services and software applications. I mean, the uplifting part of this book to me was discovering the services and third-party apps that are showing up to kind of help you deal with this onslaught. And some of them have become essential to me.
Right, right. And I love that some of them are just built in, like we just talked about. Like, turn off your badges, turn off your notifications, those sorts of things. I know there's a couple I want to ask you about, mainly because they're ones that I haven't discovered. I know you talked about some of the services that you can use to kind of help filter things out or sort of pare this down. And I'm trying to remember the name of the one.
Sanebox
is the one that I'm hearing a lot about and a lot of people using. So were you, was that something you were using before you started writing the book, or did you discover it in the process?
Well, this book started over a year ago. So I did discover it after I started writing the book, but it really became something I embraced while writing the book. And Sanebox is an interesting service. It works with Gmail, IMAP, Exchange. I mean, it works with just about any kind of account. And what they do is they look at your inbox for you, and they have the ability to filter email for you to different mailboxes. So you can, if you have a Sanebox account, you're going to have what they call a later account and a news account, and you can make different kinds of boxes if you want. And so you're giving them access to your emails, or at least your email headers. They don't see the bodies of the email. They just see who it's from and what the subject line is, etc. And they get to see how fast you reply and what you do with those emails in the past to that person, and they kind of apply their own logic. So if I get an email from my wife, they know that I always reply very quickly, and they're going to leave that in my inbox. But let's say they get I have an email from Adam. And traditionally, I don't respond to Adam's emails, you know, that day, but I respond to them later. They might put that in the later box. Or if I get an email from, you know, Trader Joe's about spicy carrots, it's going to put that one in the news box. So it's going to auto-filter your inbox as it comes in. And when I wake up in the morning, instead of having 60 or 70 things in my inbox, I might have 5 or 6. But I'm going to have other mail in different categories of boxes. This is similar to something Gmail does, but in my testing, I found Sanebox did a better job of it. And this is really super for me because I have all of these types of email coming in every day. And while I love responding to Mac Power Users listeners or Field Guide readers, I usually do that on Saturday. And so I'm not going to have to look at those every day. They're just going to accumulate for me. And then when I can sit down for a couple hours, I can go through them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense, and I've got it. I just think I'm the type of person who would rather, and realizing it's going to take me a little bit more time, maybe
do that yourself.
I do that myself, and only because I'm paranoid that I'm going to lose something letting some computer brain artificial intelligence system sort of figure that stuff out for me. I guess I have trust issues.
And also, it's a question of volume. I mean, depending on your volume, maybe you don't need to pay somebody to do that because this is a paid service. You pay for it.
Right.
And then they've got some other features.
I mean,
they've got other features too. Like one of them is you can have a mailbox with a date like tomorrow or next week or Saturday or whatever. And anything you put in there just disappears until whatever that time period is. So if I just received before we started recording an email from someone that has a question for me that, for work is going to require me to spend a little time, I just put it in the tomorrow box and it'll show up tomorrow. And now I don't have to see it, and it feels kind of good. Which was funny, because when I first started this journey, I thought, I'm not in favor of deferring email. I think that's kind of cheating, and it doesn't seem to work. And I like using OmniFocus. But, you know, there's a certain category of email I get that doesn't need to have its own special task in OmniFocus, and it doesn't need me looking at it for 3 days while I wait to do something. And SaneBox allows me to defer it. And another thing SaneBox does is I can send an email to someone, and I can put in the blank copy or the copy line, you know, 1 week at sanebox.com. And if that person doesn't reply to that email to me within 1 week, it'll send it back to me. So it reminds me to do something about it. So there's a whole bunch of things they do with that service. But the big one, I think, is the email filtering.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, and some of those things are really good, because I know I'm guilty of, you know, using my system, whether it be flags or folders or however I am organizing that stuff for follow-up, of missing things, right? It's like,
yeah,
I'll do that manual deferment. The thing is it's not going to send it back to my inbox and say, hey, dummy, you know, remember you were supposed to do this thing? I got to go back and do the review. So I'm bad on the, I know I'm bad, inherently bad on the review part. So this is another one of those things where, you know, you can develop a system. I've developed sort of a system of organizing things into folders or different locations. But again, if I don't go back and have the diligence to do that review, you know, I think you talk about this in your book, is sort of using a folder to say, you know, this is stuff I want to do later. I'm not going to reply to this right now. I want to do it later. But if you're going to throw something in there, right, you need to be the type of person who's going to go back once a week or every couple of days and go through that later folder.
Yeah, if you don't have, I call it an action folder, but whatever folder you want to put it in, if you're not going to go back and actually process it, then you're no better than just having this massive inbox. You're in the same position. I mean, and this stuff is not easy. I mean, I don't think any of us have all the answers, but I think thinking about it and looking at the available technologies can really help you, you know, kind of come to your own peace with it. I'm not sure you conquer email. I think you live with it.
Yeah.
You figure it out, you know.
Right. I want to come back to Gmail a little bit, because I am a Gmail user, and I know a lot of people are out there, and it's actually timely in terms of, you know, Mavericks has had its own struggles with Apple Mail and Gmail. And I am one of those people that uses Gmail with Apple Mail. And I was also one of these people that did the thing where, you know, Gmail has this all mail folder where if you don't label something, well, they call them labels, right? But they're basically pseudo
tags.
IMAP. Yeah. Well, they're pseudo IMAP folders, really. But Gmail handles it in a really weird way.
Yeah, because you can have multiple labels, which is
not allowed.
Consistent with IMAP.
Yeah, and this is where the problem came into play, right? Is if you didn't have something or... So one of the workarounds that a lot of Gmail users like myself would do is you could go into Gmail settings and you could basically turn off the all mail IMAP folder. Well, when the Mavericks update came out, and if you had done that, you started ending up with sort of this duplicate where you'd have emails showing up twice and those sorts of things. Apple changed the programming, and I think they've now since changed it back or whatever.
It's better now. It's better now. I don't think it's entirely resolved. I mean, I've been a very active IMAP user for years. I like IMAP, you know, because I understand it. I never completely understood Gmail because it's such an outlier with its system.
Right.
But it does have definite advantages. So when I wrote the book, I spent several months just using Gmail, and I wanted to get really good at it. And I actually gave it a whole chapter in the book. And my conclusion at the end of that experiment was, if you're going to use Gmail, I don't think you should use it in Apple Mail. I think Gmail has some really great features in it, like inbox filtering, like I was just talking about with SaneBox, but it's free with your Gmail account, even though I don't think it's quite as good. It's got labels, which are essentially built-in tags. It's got, I mean, there's a lot of features in Gmail that are pretty remarkable, but in order to make them work, you've got to use them in an environment controlled by Google, which is, I think, primarily the web. Or it's one of these apps built for Gmail, like Mailplane, which essentially creates a web view of your mail.
Right.
And I just feel like if you're going to go in with Gmail, you should use one of those instead, because you're missing out. I don't know what's the right analogy. It's like buying a really good cupcake, but not having the frosting on it, you know, because, you know, when you get on the web, Gmail gives you all that frosting that comes with a Gmail account. Whereas when you put it in a traditional, any traditional mail client built around IMAP and POP, it's like scraping all the frosting off the top. And right. Who wants to do that? I mean, the frosting is the best part. You know, I'm getting hungry,
Adam. Cheap people like me want to do that. Because, you know, honestly, if I were to pick today, I would probably go out and find a really good IMAP mail service and pay for it. The thing with Gmail was two things. One, I originally way back when set it up for my Maccast mail just because I knew I was going to be getting a large volume of mail and I didn't want to deal with storage limits, which, you know, this was 9 years ago, so we had to worry about those things back then. But pretty much now you kind of get a ton of storage with almost any service. But, you know, back then, if you wanted a lot of storage, you kind of really had to pay for it. The other thing that Google was doing for a while, though, was they were giving free Google business accounts. So if you wanted to have your own domain, you could get Gmail running behind it and not pay for it. And so I have Maccast. That's what we did with
Mac Power uses the same way.
And they're grandfathered in, right?
Yeah.
So I still have free, you know, Gmail accounts basically, but I use them as my domain email. So that's why I use it with the Mac client. So I am in essence using it. I mean, I pare Gmail down so it works as much like a standard IMAP account as I could possibly get it to work, and just use it that way. So I don't feel like I'm missing out on the frosting because I was never eating the frosting. To use your analogy.
Yeah, but the frosting's pretty good.
It is. I totally get it. So I totally get that I am forcing myself to not have features that are available to me, but simply because I just don't want to have to go buy another. And there's some great IMAP services out there that are actually pretty reasonable, but I haven't found a replacement one that's free.
Yeah.
That's really good, or, you know, gives you a lot of, I think there's some freebie services out there, but I haven't found one that sort of matches what Google gave me back in the day. And Google's not free anymore. You know, now you have to pay for it.
I do think that as Google moves forward with Gmail, they really have no interest in trying to keep it compliant with IMAP and POP standards, because that's not even what they started out trying to do. And they're going to try and put more frosting on top. And the more frosting they put on, the harder it's going to be for traditional IMAP and POP mail clients to work with their technology. So I do sense there's kind of a parting that seems to be on its way. And even though Apple's kind of fixed Apple Mail to work with it better, I just don't think it's ever going to get any better, really better.
Right. So the other thing that I sort of used Gmail for was to kind of be lazy. And I know this is another section in your book, and this is one I haven't really gotten to yet, although I noticed, I think you use one of the tools or talk about one of the tools that I use, and that is archiving. So when, just to kick things off, when I read about this Mavericks problem about all mail, one of the things I realized was that, you know, I had a bunch of email that I was just keeping on Gmail that I really didn't need anymore, because apparently what I was reading was, hey, when I go to Mavericks, it's going to try and pull down everything. You know, I got to turn all mail back on, and then it's going to try and pull down, you know, I think I had like almost 6 gigabytes of email in there, right? And I didn't want that all coming down to my local Mac. So I'm like, you know, I probably should just dump that stuff. And I ended up just dumping it, and I had really no qualms about that, because it wasn't stuff that I had. Anything that I want to archive, I'm going to put into a folder, right? I'm going to organize it in something. And the stuff that was in all mail was just stuff that I had read. It had been read, and I had, in essence, you know, said delete, but Gmail doesn't really ever delete anything unless you implicitly tell it to you know, throw it away. It just keeps everything in all mail. So,
yeah.
But at the same time, too, because I use Apple Mail for my thing, I also use an application called Mail Steward, which takes anything that comes into my inbox or any other of the other folders or IMAP mailboxes that I define, and actually puts that into a MySQL indexed database.
Yeah, isn't that a great application?
Yeah, and it creates an archive of all my... So I actually have backups of all my email, and of course that gets backed up then by all of my other backup systems, be it Time Machine or Crash Plan or Super Duper, you know, all those sorts of things. So I feel like I can probably never lose an email. If I ever need to go find one, it's somewhere.
Yeah, and it's not that hard to set up a system like that. So if you've got too much email, you know, some people do complain that the database gets so big that it slows down their email. There are great solutions out there like, you know, MailSteward to go ahead and archive your email and still be able to search it, but not have it, you know, weighing down your mail system.
Right.
That being said, you know, I've never really had much of a problem with an overwhelming mail database. And I think it's just the, you know, the Macs I'm running and seem to be keeping up with it. And as the Macs get faster, it becomes less of a problem as the email file gets bigger. I remember our pal Tim Verporten used to tell me how slow it was for him and how many problems he had. And I always wondered how many emails he was storing in there. You know?
Well, I think if you store everything, like I said, I mean, I had close to, I think, a total of 9 gigabytes or something in my Gmail. And most of it was just, you know, years and years and years of email that I never got rid of, really, because I didn't have to. You know, it was more of this sort of lazy thing. And what I love about, you know, an archiving system like MailSteward is when I went back and went, you know, I can really dump that, because guess what? I know that there's copies in my MailSteward database. It's just not sitting in mail, right? It's not in an inbox folder. It's over someplace else that if I ever need to go search and find it, I can find it. And what's great is it has great export features, so I can export it right back out to an inbox and put it right back into my mail. If I were in, you know, a .eml file, is that what the email standard file is? I mean, yeah, there's ways to get it back into mail if I wanted it there, but really probably all I need to do is be able to review that information, right? I just need to get the data out of that message. And I know you go into some other systems, but where I'm leading with this is this whole concept of coming back to what we were talking, the philosophical things. You know, I don't know where I developed the sense that, like, I can't lose email. Right, like every email that I have is precious. And
yeah, I wrote about that in the book because I was thinking about my birthday came, you know, and went while I was writing this book, and I had some really nice cards from some friends, and I threw them. I had them for a couple of days, and they made me happy, but ultimately I threw them away because I scanned them first, of course, because I wrote a book on paperless.
But right,
I threw them away. And maybe I'm kind of defeating the point saying I scanned it. But either way, as I was looking at them in the trash, I'm like, well, if I could throw away a birthday card from a friend, why am I keeping so much of this email that arrives in my inbox? It's just like, hey, confirming we're meeting for lunch tomorrow.
Right.
Why am I keeping that? Yeah. You know? Why am I adding that to the database?
Yeah.
What is the, you know, am I so important that someday someone's going to want to know?
And plus the NSA probably has a copy of that for you anyway.
Yeah, I could always just call up the government if I need it.
Obviously, that's a joke, kind of.
sort of.
But I mean, and to that point, and that's what I was sort of realizing as I was going this, and I guess I don't know why we do that, but I think it's a common problem. And that was another thing that, like, a system like MailSteward finally allowed me to realize, you know what, I actually do have a copy of it. It's just tucked away really, really, you know, deeper than I want. But at the same time, and maybe that's like your scanning of the card, you know, you at least have some record of it, even if it's not immediately available and accessible, you know, by opening your drawer, you know, grabbing the card off the table. If you suddenly someday said, you know, I really want to see that card from 10 years ago, or for me, if I really want to read that email about that appointment I had in 2006, I know where I can go get it. But again, at the same time, it's just like, why do I have that need? Like, oh, I might need that email someday. You know, it's a hoarder mentality. It's a digital hoarder mentality. And I'm not even like that in my personal life. I know other people that are sort of hang on to things. I'm not real clingy with physical things, but for some reason, my email, I feel different about. So,
yeah.
But I don't think I'm strange.
I attribute some of it to just growing up with computers. And I remember, you know, I've been on the whole journey. I remember when I used to save my programs to cassette tape. And now you move to today with SSD and you know, massive amounts of storage. There's part of me that is still just enthralled by the fact that I have this much storage available to me. I have this Drobo in my house, and I'm like looking for things to put on it because the fact that I have it there makes me want to fill it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I'll mention,
as you can see, I have a lot of hang-ups.
I think we all do. But that's what's great about, you know, you having this sort of outlet where you can write about these things, and I think a lot of people can relate, and that's what I love about these books. You know, this field guide series is, I think, a lot of us, it's not just about the technology. The fact that it's about workflows and then gets into a little bit of the philosophy, I think, really provides a lot of usefulness to a lot of people.
I'm glad that that resonates with you, because that's really what I'm trying to do. I want these books to be fun. I want them to tell a story, and I want people to finish them being a little better at something. I mean, that's, for me, the big payoff is when I get emails from people saying, hey, thanks a lot. That really helped me. Now I can do something faster. Maybe I can get home with my kids faster, whatever. It's as goofy as it sounds, writing these books feels like the most important thing I've ever done in my life. And I just really enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the last thing I want to comment on, because I know some people are familiar with the other books, and you do these in iBooks Author, which is an awesome technology and allows you to do things like these great screencasts. So once again, you know, email has these great screencasts in there, so you can actually really illustrate some of the concepts. I know watched
there's 36 in this one.
I watched the one on Pop, and it was awesome, because that's something I'm constantly having to explain to people, is why, you know, IMAP is different than Pop, and what sort of some of the hangups of Pop are. But something new in this one that I don't think you've done these before, unless I've missed it. This one has some audio interviews at the end with different people, like you said, from different industries, which I think really helps illustrate that, you know, this thing of email does kind of cross a bunch of different areas. And yeah, so I just wanted to point those out. Yeah.
Yeah, I did those at the end of the Markdown book too, but I did a lot more of them in this one, because, you know, I felt like, you know, looking back at Paperless, which was the first one of the series, book of the series, I felt like I did a really good job of explaining my thoughts and my workflows and how I thought you should go paperless. But there were people with different opinions, and I wish I had included theirs as well. And that's what led me to say, well, you know what? After I spend 300 pages and 36 screencasts and all this time telling you how I think things work and, you know, giving you my recommendations, why not have a few people with different points of view? And this book has 8 interviews with different people, and some of them are like, you know, Merlin Mann, who's like the super email guy, right? I mean, Merlin is kind of the leader in this whole, like, Inbox Zero was his idea, and just I'm really, you know, Merlin has brought a lot to the conversation, so it was really great talking to him about email. But then I talked to Jeff Takeman, who's a surgeon, and I talked to Rob Corddry, who's an actor, and I just talked to people who come from different walks of life about how they deal with email. And I intentionally reached out to some people who are like Power Gmail users and some people who are Power IMAP users. I just wanted the listeners, I guess, reader/listener/watcher of this book to get some additional perspective. And so that's chapter 10, and there's a bunch of those.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm a big fan of all these books. I have them all. I like them all. But this one in particular, I think is going to resonate with a lot of people. And that's another thing about these is the last thing I probably should point out is that, you know, these are in iBooks, they're done in iBooks Author, but you also have PDF versions available. You have other versions. So it's not just for, you know, people who have iPads and iMacs and stuff like that. If people on other platforms, I think, can benefit from a lot of the content in here. Of course, it has a Mac slant to it, but I mean, we're talking about email and Gmail and those sorts of things on a lot of levels as well.
Yeah, I haven't even, you know, tried to sell it to PC users because it's really a Mac and iOS thing. But I've got some nice emails from people on the PC side because there's a lot of tactical stuff in here and services. And so some people have read and said, hey, I don't use Apple Mail or an iOS device, but I really liked it. And I keep wondering, well, how did that person even find this book? but, you know, in terms of the format, I would, if you're out there buying it, I would recommend if you have Mavericks on your Mac or an iPad and you have it available in the iBook stores in 51 countries, I would say the first choice would be to buy it through the iBook store. And that's telling you that because I actually make less money when you buy it through the iBook store. But I do think it's a much better experience because everything is incorporated into one file. If you don't live in a country that has the iBook store, you don't have an iPad or a Mac, there's a PDF version available from the website. It's macsparky.com/email. And you get a PDF of the book, and you get all of those media files. You get the audio files of the interviews. You get the screencast movies. So you get to see, and all the screenshots in the book, I have copies of all those in there too. So you get all of the same media, but then you've got to go track it down. You know, right. Like you're reading the PDF and it says, well, screencast 4.2, then you got to go to the screencast folder and open that up. So it's not as immersive.
No. The iBooks experience, I think, is the best way to experience the book. But I just did want to point out that, you know, there are other options if that's not the world that you live in.
Yeah.
So
it's really fun making these books. I mean, I made some books for a traditional publisher before I started doing this. And it just, I'm so spoiled now. It's like when I want to show the reader how to do something, it's really hard to explain that in technical terms with one or two screenshots, where I can make a 3-minute screencast and you can watch me do it on the screen and you can follow along. And that's like a thousand times better.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's a way I prefer to learn, you know, to read about something, but then, like I said, to actually be able to see it illustrated, and, you know, talked through. I mean, that's how I think a lot of us learn, right? That's why we have lectures in college. That's why we have seminars that we go to. You know, it's not just one form of learning. You can kind of mix all those things together, and you don't, it's all in one place.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. And I try to make the books kind of fun too. You know, I try to put little funny bits in it occasionally. You know, I make rough attempts at it at least.
Oh yeah. There's some great sidebars and humor as well. So I know I enjoy them. It sounds like other folks are too, from what you've been telling me. So if people haven't checked them out, they are on the iBooks store. The latest one is called Email. What's the best way for people to find them or search for them if they're going to do that?
If you want to get kind of an overview, just go to maxsparky.com/fieldguides or just go to maxsparky.com. I've got all four of them right there and you can read about each of them. And that'll send you into the PDF version or the iBook store or whatever, you know, version you want. Or you can just go on iTunes and search David Sparks and it shows up that way as well.
Perfect. And then I guess we should also throw in a quick plug for the podcast. Do a podcast where you guys talk about workflows for not just email, but all sorts of things, right? You and Katie Floyd.
Over at themacpowerusers.com. And we love having listeners come in and give us feedback there as well.
Cool. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate it.
So there you go, David Sparks and his new field guide email. I hope you got some great tips out of that. And be sure to go pick up the book on the iBook store now and also check out his podcast and all the other great stuff Dave's doing. Dave is a smart, smart guy, especially when it comes to all this workflow stuff. He is my guru. He might have Merlin Mann as his guru on some of these things, but David is my guru. Like that guy. Anyway, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and say thank you to all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone or iPad, and Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. Also, be sure to check out PDF Pen Scan Plus, their latest application available on the App Store. Transporter by Connected Data. You can get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control, security, and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. You can get 10% off your own personal cloud by using the coupon code MACCAST over at filetransporter.com/MACCAST. Get all the details there. Big thank you to Transporter. And also Gazelle. You know, Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed. I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. And check out the MacCast website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, Twitter, it's twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you want to find the Google Plus community, just search for MacCast on Google Plus. It'll pop right up. And I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.